keep the peace to build the future. The new mission of your AAF. Peace is the end of war, but not the battle. Peace is no negative thing. It is vital, positive, and precarious. To guard it is a constant vigil. That is the mission of your Army Air Forces. And to bring the American people an authoritative and frank and up-to-the-minute report on the progress of that mission each week is the function of this program, your AAF. Through our on-the-spot reporters at home and abroad, you will hear...
The latest official news on demobilization plans. The story of our occupation air forces direct from your men overseas. The secrets of America's astounding scientific achievements in the air and how they will affect your peacetime future. And tonight, for the first time in the air, the three Doolittle flyers just liberated from a Japanese prison camp.
And each week, the Army Air Forces Orchestra will bring you the best of the top tunes of the day.
He's 9 months and has 48 points. How soon can he come back to me?
I just got drafted in the Air Force last month, and I guess I'm going over. But I haven't any special training. What good will I be overseas?
They say we got pilots that fly without a pilot. Are they kidding? What does that mean?
Sure, we built the biggest Air Force in the world, but now it's all over. What are we going to do with all those planes?
Yes, the people want to know, and they are entitled to the answer. Each week on this program, your AAF will bring you an authoritative report on its continuing operations around the world and its plans for the future. As the spearhead of victory, the Army Air Forces were built by millions of Americans in and out of uniform. As your shield for peace, they still remain truly your AAF. While the men gather in the corners of the earth to start that long, sweet journey back, their closest link with home is still the radio and music. Music in the form America and they know best. Now the orchestra and Jerome Kearns, All the Things You Are.
Thank you.
1942, in the face of filthy weather, overwhelmingly superior air forces, and the gravest risk of inevitable death or capture, Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle and his handful of flyers bombed Tokyo. On that raid were Lieutenant Chase J. Nielsen of Hiram, Utah, Lieutenant Robert Height of Earth, Texas, and Sergeant Jacob DeShazer of Madras, Oregon. For 3 years now, listed as missing in action. But with the surrender of Japan, all three were found alive and whole. To meet them as they stepped from a plane at Chungking Airport went AAF combat reporter Captain Howard Sheldon. And now, by Army wire recorder, he brings you the first message home from these survivors of that gallant Doolittle raid over Tokyo. Go ahead, Chungking.
Lieutenant Nielsen, before we ask you one or two questions, is there anyone you'd like to talk to on this wire recorder? Anyone you'd like to deliver a personal message to? I think you've earned the right to break a radio rule here.
Well, sir, I'd certainly like to say hello to my darling wife and my family. It's been a long time I've been away from home, and I'll certainly be glad to get back with them. And back with the rest of you good old American Yankees.
I know they'll be very, very glad to hear that. What's the first thing in the line of food? I know your food hasn't been too good, that you want to obtain when you get back to the States.
One large T-bone steak and a good helping of French fries.
How about the other courses? What do you want with that?
Well, I haven't quite decided yet, but it will be plenty.
I certainly hope you get it. What was your job aboard the B-25, Lieutenant Nielsen?
I was a navigator.
Did you ever have any doubts while you were in prison camp as to the outcome of this scrap?
No, sir, I have never had any doubt because I know the cooperation that the American people have.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant. Now I'm going to turn the microphone over to AAF reporter Corporal Jay Miltner, who will interview the enlisted man of this crew.
Hello, Corporal.
Hello, I'm Sergeant now.
You're a Sergeant now? My, it's my error.
It's a long time to... It's a long, hard way to make Sergeant, but I finally made it.
Well, good. Tell me, what was your position on the ship?
Bombardier.
Bombardier. And when you get back to the States, what do you want most of all?
Cheeseburger.
Anything else?
More see my mother.
Well, that's fine. What was your civilian occupation?
Turkey raiser.
A turkey raiser. Do you plan to go back to that when you get back in the States?
No. I guess I'll go back to preaching now.
Oh, I see. Well, tell me, is there anything that you want to say to your family? We're breaking all rules of radio, but I think it's very appropriate at this time that you come out and say what you feel toward your family, wife, or sweetheart. So go right ahead.
Well, Mother, I'm sure glad I'm alive, and I suppose you are, too.
Well, thank you very much, Sergeant. And now back to Captain Sheldon.
Our next interviewee is Lieutenant Robert L. Height of Earth, Texas. And when did you first hear the news of Japan's surrender, Lieutenant Height?
I first heard the news of the surrender on the 15th day of August.
Where were you at the time?
I was in Peking, sir.
Did the Japanese advise you of that?
Yes.
They came into your cell and told you? Is that how they did it?
They took us out to take a shower, and they said, well, today the war is over.
And needless to say, you were very, very happy. Now, Lieutenant, I want you to go ahead and talk to whomever you wish. Just say it right into this microphone, and we hope that they catch it over the radio back in the States. Go ahead.
Hello, Yankees. Hello, Mother and loving family. I'm coming home.
That was the first radio message home from three survivors of the Doolittle raid, picked up by Army wire recorder in Chungking. But while that wire recorder was being rushed by bomber pouch halfway around the world, the silver wings of the Air Transport Command were hurrying these men home to America. And at a microphone in Washington tonight is Lieutenant, now Captain, Robert Height, home at last. Go ahead, Captain Height.
I don't know how to put into words what I want to say. I'm still pretty confused. Mainly, I'm home. I don't think anyone could tell you how that feels to me, or to Captain Nielsen and Sergeant DeShazer. We'd like to thank America for remembering us, and we thank God that we are alive today. I don't know what we expected America to look like, but it was a surprise. She hadn't changed at all, and that was good. A fellow doesn't get too much news in a prison camp, and in these last few days we've been sort of catching up. Jet planes, atomic bombs, rocket guns, real Buck Rogers stuff. If there should ever be a next time, America may not stay the same. If we need planes, if we need money for research, if we need men and training, they've got to be there, in case. Because take it from three guys who spent 3 years thinking maybe they never would see her again. America is a pretty wonderful place.
Thank you, Captain Height. This is your AAF. Join us next week for a half hour of music by the AAF Orchestra and singing voices, first-hand news of your men in the service, and authoritative reports of our continuing operations to keep the peace, to build the future, the mission of your AAF.
Here's a bulletin from our New York newsroom, San Diego, California. Vice Admiral John Sidney McCain, 61, commander of the famous Navy Task Force 38, died of a heart attack at his home in nearby Coronado tonight. This bulletin was from our New York newsroom. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
The President of the United States sent a message to the Congress in which he outlined the program which he feels must be adopted to meet the problems of peace. Tonight, Mr. John W. Snyder, Director of the Office of War Mobilization and Reconversion, will discuss from Washington the President's message and the problems of reconversion. Mr. John W. Snyder.
Good evening. We have now begun to work towards the goals for which we fought the war. The enemy would have destroyed our way of living if he could. Fortunately, we have destroyed the enemy. We have proven the strength of the democratic system. Now we can get on with our job of building a greater America with greater opportunities for everyone. We're all working on that job. The Congress has cut short its well-earned vacation to put into force a strong legislative program that will speed the transition from war to peace. Today, President Truman has laid his recommendations before the Congress. Some of the legislation recommended is intended to meet the immediate needs of our economy. Some of it has a longer-range view. Every one of us should know as much as possible about the job ahead. It is no harder than the task we have just completed victoriously. But it will not be an easy job. Nevertheless, we enter upon this new task with complete confidence. We have proven our strength in a production battle such as the world has never seen before. We know that we can build a greater and more prosperous of America for every American. When we set out to win the war, we took an inventory of our resources. We looked at the job that had to be done, and then we expanded and developed those resources to do the job. That was our national grand strategy. I think we may say, and with appropriate pride, that it was well done. Now we are working out a strategy of equal or greater importance to achieve an enduring and widespread prosperity. Our resources are largely the same with which we won the war. They are the largest production plant in the world. They are the know-how of business, the management that ran those plants. They are the energy and the initiative and the vigor of all our workers, of all our people. This will be increased now because millions of men and women are coming back from the armed forces. They are coming back with eagerness for this new task. It is the one thing they have been thinking about throughout the years of the war, getting home again and becoming once more a working and producing part of the growing America they love. Our resources, therefore, are considerable. We know that we can and will expand them if they're needed. But what is the job we have to do? Briefly, we have to close out our wartime business and speed up on all peacetime activities. Closing out wartime business is complicated, but the steps that have to be taken are largely a matter of using everyday procedures of the business world. Suppose we take a look at how the job is going along. The first step in closing out wartime business is for the government to cancel its contract for war goods. We have cut our munitions production 60% below the July level. In December, the cut will rise to 80%. The rest is needed to take care of our troops overseas, occupying enemy countries, and here at home. That's a good start. The next step is to settle up accounts with businessmen on the canceled contract. The government intends to complete settlement of terminated contracts within a year. Present performance indicates that this can be accomplished if business will do its part by filing claims promptly. A third step is to clear war factories of government-owned machinery and the odds and ends of war production. This has to be done so that the factories can be retooled quickly for peacetime production. The government is required by law to clear plants within 60 days after a manufacturer requests it. So far, the government has met this schedule very well. So much for closing out war business. Now suppose we look at some of the steps for expanding peacetime production. First of all, the men and women who produce the goods for war have to be free to return to peacetime jobs and peacetime production. Within 10 days after Japan surrendered, 2,700,000 men and women had been released from war work. Of these, 900,000 immediately were shifted to other jobs within the same plant. Within the next 6 or 8 weeks, another 1.5 to 2 million workers are expected to be released. This is a great many, and they will be further augmented by releases from the armed service. Within 10 months, the Army plans to discharge approximately 6 million, and the Navy, 2,800,000. Obviously, our economy as a whole will have to be operating at high speed before all these workers can be put back to work. For some, the wait will be brief. For others, it will be longer. In his message today, the President recommended to Congress that the United States Employment Service continue for the present to operate as a national chain of offices until the shift of war workers and veterans to peacetime jobs is safely made. These offices are important in helping to bring jobs and job hunters together quickly. Only by filling all jobs and filling them as quickly as they become vacant, can we be really sure that we will move swiftly through the transition to peace. The second step in speeding up peacetime activities falls into two parts. One of these is a swift release of materials formerly needed for war. This is being accomplished by cancellation of war contracts which formerly used those materials, and by the action of the War Production Board in removing a great many of its wartime controls so that the economy can operate freely. The second part of this step calls for parallel and concerted action by various agencies of the government to increase production under the guidance of my office and the Office of Economic Stabilization. Responsibility for speeding reconversion of factories and for assuring the widest possible distribution of materials which remain scarce with the War Production Board. It has retained a few very important controls to accomplish this. The War Production Board also has given special assistance to small business and has set up machinery so that it can swiftly find and break any production bottlenecks that develop. Price and rent ceilings remain the responsibility of the Office of Price Administration and the Secretary of Agriculture. These agencies will protect the consumer everywhere against undue increase. At the same time, they must adjust price ceilings which threaten to slow up reconversion. Prices already have been set on many products which have been off the market during the war years. For consumers, these prices are close to the 1942 level. Ceilings on other articles will be established on the same principles of fairness, both to the consumer and to business. Wage adjustment is the responsibility of the National War Labor Board, which has been authorized to increase wages where low pay would interfere with reconversion, or would prevent expansion for production, giving full consideration to price ceiling control. Wage increases, like the adjustment of price ceiling, must be watched closely to prevent inflation. The stabilization of our price and cost structure is most important to the expansion of industry, and is equally important to every individual citizen. Until enough goods are being manufactured to meet the demands of those who want to buy, the government must hold the line against inflation on those articles that remain scarce. At the same time, it must make sure that the national income continues high for the sake of the country's future prosperity. Stabilization is a many-sided problem. There is a great deal of money in circulation, while many of the commodities that people want to buy still are not available for a while. There is a big demand for goods generally, and that is good. But rental and price ceilings must be kept in force for the time being wherever the supply does not approach a balance with the demand. This is for the protection of buyers everywhere who must make their income cover the things they wish to buy. It is also for the protection of business, which must be sure its cost and which would be equally damaged by runaway prices. There will also be pressures towards deflation. Unemployment, even though temporary, will be one of these. Because these factors reduce the purchasing power of the people, they tend to have a depressing influence upon our entire economy. Some parts of the country will feel the effect of this more than others, but if allowed to continue, all of us would feel it. To combat the threat of deflation, as well as to meet the human needs of the workers, the President today recommended that the Congress broaden the government's policy on benefits for the unemployed. This would be done by authorizing federal supplements to the payments made to the unemployed in the various states, and by increasing the duration of these payments. Also by extending unemployment benefits to workers who are not protected now. The President further recommended revision of the Fair Labor Standards Act to provide higher minimum wage. There is a third major step in the drive to change over our economy swiftly from war to peacetime prosperity. It concerns financing. The government already has machinery in operation to cooperate with commercial banks by guaranteeing loans for reconversion of plants and on canceled contracts pending settlement. The government also will assist in making business loans to veterans and to businessmen. In addition, the President recommended to Congress that Congress revise taxes to encourage the expansion of business. These are some of the main steps our nation is taking in order to win for us an enduring and stable prosperity. The President has outlined other parts of our grand strategy, but I cannot, in this brief time, discuss all of them. But I do want to mention a few. The President has endorsed legislation that would recognize full employment as the economic goal of our country. He has recommended appropriations for state aid roads, for planning public works for the future, and for resuming slum clearance in cooperation with local government and private industry. For agriculture, the President has requested the continuation of the price support and crop insurance program and the stimulation of export trade. Special assistance has been recommended for small business. These acts by the Congress and the operation of the executive agency under the leadership of President Truman provide the framework in which the government will work for the speedy transition to peacetime production. We are going ahead. We're going to build a greater America with greater opportunities for every American. There is no mystery about the way this will be done. We, every man and woman of us, will do this job in the same way that we won the war. We will apply to it every human and material resource of the nation. We have made a good beginning, but we must continue to appraise the situation realistically. So far, we have only begun the task of changing our economy from war to peacetime prosperity. I know that some of us feel that after the long grind of the war, we would like to take things a little easy for a while. I wish this were possible. However, it is no more possible now than it would have been possible to win the war if our armies had stopped at the German border or we had quit fighting at Iwo Jima. We have to keep pushing day by day to get the machinery of production rolling and to build the great America we all want. Yes, we have made a good start, but we shall need the combined efforts of all of us to finish the job. The government will do its full share, mindful of the interests of the whole people, it will assist each group to do its part in bringing the nation from war to an enduring and prosperous peace.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, today the President of the United States sent a message to Congress in which he outlined the program which he feels must be adopted to meet the problems of peace. And this evening from Washington, D.C., we've had the pleasure of listening to Mr. John W. Snyder, Director of the Office of War Mobilization and Reconversion, discussing the President's message to Congress on the problems of peace. Mr. Snyder spoke to you from the studios of WMAL in Washington, D.C. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.